demonstrated that yes, that Africa can indeed stand on its own feet. And what and why am I using Burkina Faso as an example? Because one of the things that had plagued the African continent and various countries has been terrorism. It has now come to light, given the Department of Government Efficiency run by Elon Musk, revelations about the role of U.S. aid in Africa, and that much of that aid has been going to terrorists, you know, so funding of Boko Haram, funding of Al-Qaeda, and so on. What Ibrahim Traore has done, he was able to use his power as the president of the country in order to rid the country of much of the terrorists. What then happened was, as they pushed out the French and the terror groupings, they were able to take over much of the mining industry, the gold and uranium and platinum mining industry and so on. And with the result that now, that funding is now coming into the fiscus of the government. And Ibrahim Traore has shown, I mean, he's built something like 50 or 60 schools, new schools. He's built many hospitals, road infrastructure. He's built ports, you know, his road infrastructure, his bridges, and so on, etc., giving people access to more. He's upgraded the agriculture and so on. So this is clear evidence that if Africa can rid itself from Western domination and the colonialist past, and of course. Now it's out in the open that it was the West that has been funding these terrorists. Africa would be able to become very prosperous if they are able to use their own resources.
South Africa's government has vowed not to let the US's withdrawal of $427 million in HIV/AIDS support collapse its programs, which are among the largest in the world. Experts say that other African countries should follow suit in building more sustainable, self-reliant health systems in response to foreign aid reductions.
The actions by the South African government actually was in the interest of South Africa. The Nigerian government, after the withdrawal of the aid, took up the responsibility of providing drugs and the necessary things to people living with HIV/AIDS. These are welcome. That's the way it should be from the beginning. So African countries, we want to get the prevailing atmosphere in Africa is we don't need this aid. Don't give us any aid. Come if you, we want fair trade and we will trade with anyone. You can't dictate to us whether we will trade with this country or that country. No, we want fair deal. If it's gold you are interested in, there is a market price. It's a fair market price. Buy it at that. You can't buy it at 80 cents and sell it at 200 euros, and then tell us that you turn around and give us 10 billion in aid. We could have gotten that money ourselves from the minerals, far more, maybe 20 times more. So we don't, this whole attitude that Africa is a continent that has to be helped with, it is just nonsense, and we don't want any of it again.
While Trump met African leaders amid plans to extract critical minerals from the continent, he simultaneously slashed U.S. aid assistance for African health programs. Dr. Jemanze, how do you interpret this contradiction that while Trump is eager to tap into Africa's mineral wealth, he seems indifferent to the lives of Africans, as evidenced by the deep cuts to life-saving aid like HIV support?
Well, once it comes to the actions of President Trump, he, I think, is guided by the best interest of the United States, as far as they see it. And we should be guided by our own best interest. As I have said before, we do not need Western or any other person's aid. What we need is fair trade. If he's negotiating with African presidents and say, okay, we're interested in your minerals, not come here for extraction, we want to buy it at the international market, fine. We are open for business. We tell you the price. The price is the international price, market price. You pay for it and you take it. So that should be our attitude.
There you have it. For Africa to develop and cut aid dependency, it should benefit from its own minerals and should not let countries such as the U.S. continue looting the continent's resources. I'd like to thank our guests today, Mr. Fahri Hassan and Prince Dr. Philip Njemanze, for their incisive analysis.
Hello, I am Jannat Ali, and welcome to a new series of programs that will delve into some of the ancient African civilizations. As Africa moves to become a focal point of the world's economy, reflecting on the continent's rich civilization is critical to preserve its pure identity. Today, let us get to know more about the Carthage civilization. Founded by the Phoenician settlers from around Tyre, 814 BCE, Carthage was located in present-day Tunisia. The city's strategic location on the Mediterranean coast facilitated trade and naval dominance, making it one of the wealthiest cities in the ancient world by the 4th century BCE. Carthage controlled territories across North Africa, southern Iberia, and several Mediterranean islands. Carthage's rise to power was marked by its maritime capabilities, extensive trade networks, and a formidable navy. The city's economy thrived on trading goods such as gold, silver, ivory, and textile. Carthage also developed a complex political system with a powerful ruling elite and a strong military composed of mercenaries from various regions. However, Carthage's prosperity eventually led to the conflict with the Roman Republic. The two powers clashed in a series of wars known as the Punic Wars between 264 and 146 BCE. Despite the famous exploits of General Hannibal, Carthage ultimately lost to Rome. The Third Punic War between 149 and 146 BCE ended with the complete destruction of the Carthage by the Romans. The city was razed and the territory annexed. The Romans later rebuilt Carthage, making it an important center of the Roman Empire. Today, the ruins of Carthage are a UNESCO World Heritage Site, preserving the remnants of this once great civilization. Notable structures include the Birissa Hill, the Antonine Baths, and the Punic Port, all maintained as part of the Carthage National Archaeological Park. That was a brief description of the Carthage civilization. From me, Jannat Ali, it's goodbye for now.
And that brings us to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. On behalf of the entire crew, it's me, Mubarak Kenya, saying goodbye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back, dear listeners. This is Iran Radio, and this is some interesting facts about Holy Quran. Be with us. Chapter Yasin is considered the heart of the Quran for its tremendous benefits for the believer. The best drink according to Quran is milk. In the Quran, Allah also describes the rivers of milk in heaven. The best food according to Quran is honey, which cures several problems and is the sweetest gift to humans from Allah. Normally, the Quran declares Friday as the most blessed day of the week, and the month of Ramadan is the best month of the year, and the night of Qadr has been described as a night better than 1,000 months. Its significance is described in chapter Al-Qadr. We'll listen to the continuation of the programs on Iran Radio. Now for this hour, we have Q&A on Islamic beliefs. Then it's time for Spotlight. Coming up next is Q&A on Islamic beliefs. Stay with us.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Answering your doubts and questions. And questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman? Allah, who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to this episode of Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. You might find it Q&A on Islamic Beliefs in our website, iranradio.ir. I am Atal, the host of this program. With me in the studio, we have Sheikh Karimi to answer today's questions. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh. Welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
I don't know, you might have seen the painting by Hassan Ruhul Amin, mm-hmm. Hadith al-Kasa, you know, it's a really, really beautiful painting, a big picture, which is painted by Hassan Ruhul Amin. For information, he is very much famous for the religious theme of his painting. Just go and Google it, you might find it. But today's question is related to Hadith al-Kasa too, that who narrated the event of the cloak, which is translated, you know, Hadith al-Kasa, and what is the importance of this event, Sheikh Karimi?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. You know, sometimes the question is about Hadith al-Kasa, as mentioned in Mafatih al-Jinan by Sheikh Abbas Qummi. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the question is about the event of Kasa. And these are two different stories and two different questions. Because of the fact that the event is mentioned in many sources, both Shia and Sunni sources. But the hadith, as mentioned by Sheikh Abbas Qummi in Mafatih al-Jinan, is mentioned in some of the sources, and I will explain both, inshallah.
Mm-hmm.
So there are many narrations. This very story is motivator that when the verse of Tathir in chapter Ahzab, chapter 33, verse 33 was revealed, إِنَّمَا يُرِيدُ اللَّهُ لِيُذْهِبَ عَنْكُمُ الرِّجْسَ أَهْلَ الْبَيْتِ وَيُطَهِّرَكُمْ تَطْهِيرًا. Allah wills that remove all impurity from you, the Ahlul Bayt, and purify you, a thorough purification. The Prophet mentioned that this verse is referring to his beloved daughter, Zahra Salman alayha, Imam Ali alayhi salam, Hassan and Hussein alayhi salam.
Right.
This is for sure, this is motivator, and mentioned by, so many narrators in both Shia and Sunni sources.
Yes.
And according to some of these reports, it happened through the event of Kisa or cloak.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, the main story, according to many narrations, yes, is what happened in the house of Umm Salama. So, Umm Salama is one of the main narrators of this narration, okay, of Kisa.
The wife of Prophet Muhammad.
Yeah, he's one of the wives of the Prophet. It's been mentioned that the Prophet was in the house of Umm Salama, and he told her that he's about to receive a very significant message from God. So he asked Umm Salama not let any person to enter the house. Umm Salama says that then Fatima Salamun alayha came to the door, bringing a special food for the Prophet.
Yes.
So for sure I couldn't prevent her, and Fatima Salamun alayha entered. Seeing his daughter, Zahra, the Prophet told her that go and bring your husband and two children.
Mm-hmm.
So Lady Zahra salamu alayha immediately went to her house, and Imam Ali and Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein alayhi salam also came. And Umm Salama, according to one narration, was engaged in prayer, in Salat.
Yes.
The Prophet had what they called it a Khaybari kisa, mm-hmm. or Aba,
yes.
a Khaybari piece of cloth. He put this cloth over the heads of these four people.
All right.
Imam Ali, Lady Zahra, Hassan and Hussein, alayhi salam.
And he himself, or no?
Yeah, he himself
okay.
included, according to some versions, and according to some other versions, he was not included. But the famous narrations are referring to the fact that the Holy Prophet himself was
like
also
an umbrella shelter, you know, over the heads of these four people. That's right.
Then he said that, "Oh Allah, these are the Ahlul Bayt, and purify them, remove any kind of impurity from them." And at this moment, the verse that here was revealed, "Innama yuridu Allah liyuthiba 'ankum ar-rijsa Ahlul Bayt wa yutahhirakum tathira." So
Hadith al-Kisa was before the revelation of Ayatul Tathir.
The event of Kisa.
The
yeah.
event of Kisa
yeah.
took place before. But Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala somehow prepared
yeah.
Prophet Muhammad yeah. for such a revelation.
Exactly.
Right. Okay.
So this is a very famous event.
Event, that's right.
I'm not going to talk about Hadith of Kisa. I'll mention Mafatih al-Jinan. I will talk about that later.
All right.
The event of Kisa is, as I mentioned, at least Mustafiz, if not Mutawatir, it is mentioned in many narrations. Once Aisha, another wife of the Prophet, was asked about the verse, she says that this verse was revealed in the house of my sister, Umm Salama. And, I mean, our dear listeners, if they want to know about the Sunni narrations in this regard, they can refer to Shawahid al-Tanzil by Hakim Hasakani, the famous Sunni
yes.
scholar. He had narrated tens of narrations under the verse of Tathir.
Is it so that Umm Salama wanted to join them too?
Yeah, sure.
But Prophet Muhammad did not let her.
Yeah, you know, one of the discussions among the Shia and Sunnis is about the concept of Ahlul Bayt as mentioned in chapter Ahzab. Because prior to this verse, the addresses of the verses are the wives of the Prophet. Mm-hmm. After the verse of Tathir, again, the verses are addressing the wives of the Prophet.
Yes.
In between, we have Ayatul Tathir,
yes.
which is a very significant verse, talking about the purification of the Ahlul Bayt. Now, the question is, who are the Ahlul Bayt?
Yes.
According to Sunni scholars, the famous idea is that the wives of the Prophet are included, and according to Shia scholars, they are not included. One of the reasons that the Shia scholars mentioned is this very narration of Umm Salama. She asked the Prophet that, am I included in the Ahlul Bayt that you are praying for? And the verse was revealed about them. The Prophet said, "Ante ila khair," you are a righteous person, meaning mm-hmm. that although you are a virtuous lady, but you are not included in Ahlul Bayt.
Right.
And we have other narrations in Sunni sources as well. So according to Shia scholars, even the Sunni sources refer to the fact that Ahlul Bayt, as mentioned in Ayatul Tathir, is only limited to, these five great personalities, and not the wives of the Prophet. This event is mentioned in many Shia sources, Usul al-Kafi, Amal Bashir Tusi, and many books of tafsir, exegesis, like Tafsir al-Qummi, Tafsir al-Furat, Majmu' al-Bayan, and so on and so forth.
Linguistically speaking, is it true that this ayah, between the ayahs before and after of Ayatul Tathir, change? I mean, in terms of the pronouns, in
exactly.
terms of the context?
This is another indication that the Shia scholars refer to. Before this verse, we have Ya Nisa and Nabil Lastunna. All the pronouns and the verbs are in feminine form.
Yes.
When it comes to Ayatul Tathir, suddenly the tone changes, pronoun and the verb change it into masculine form. Innama yuridu Allah liyuthiba 'ankum. Kum is a masculine pronoun.
Yes.
Wa yutahhirakum tathira.
Okay.
And then again after ayatul tathir, again we have feminine pronouns and verbs, which means that the addressee of this special verse must be different from the previous verses and the next verses.
So that the people might not confuse Ahlul Bayt I mean, the people of the house of Prophet Muhammad, sure, the very physical house,
yeah,
with the Ahl al-Bayt, I mean, the yeah, house of the Prophet yeah, Muhammad. Okay.
This is it. I mean, we are not going to go to that okay, discussion, but right, just to answer this point, yes, I mean, according to Arabic language, some people argue that, I mean, the wives of the Prophet are of a person are among his okay, Ahl, his, I mean, members.
Yes.
And that is why the wife of Ibrahim is mentioned as one of his family members.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? This is true. But the point is that in this case, we need to refer to the narrations. And the narrations, I mean, prove the fact that the wives of the Prophet are excluded from Ahl al-Bayt. Although we have one narration in Sunni sources, according to which he says that a person's wife cannot be considered as his Ahl, because they may separate from that house
right,
through divorce, for example.
Okay.
So Ahl is only referring to the
so
children.
The line has to be made between Ahl al-Bayt and Ahl al-Bayt. I mean, because yeah, it might make confusion in the, for example, next years, you know, that what do you mean exactly by Ahl al-Bayt? Is that's it still so the wives of Prophet Muhammad or the people who are living, the children, or no, it has some specific meaning. That's all right.
So as I mentioned, this event is mentioned also in many Sunni sources like Jamu al-Bayan by Tabari, Tafsir al-Quran al-Azim by Razi, al-Kashaf by Zamakhshari, Ad-Dur al-Manthur by Suyuti, and many others. So mm-hmm, this event has happened for sure, and many Shia scholars have mentioned this. Sometimes the question is that why Imam alayhi salam never mentioned his right to imamate. He had mentioned that in many occasions.
Yes.
So for example, when he was talking to one of the caliphs, he referred to the hadith of the story of Qisa, and he said that was the verse of Tathir revealed about me and my family members or for your family members? And the caliph mentioned that for you and for your family members. Even the 6-member council after the demise of the second caliph, Imam alayhi salam mentioned ayatul Tathir and the fact that it was revealed about him and his family members. Imam Hassan alayhi salam also has mentioned this event. So this is about the event of Qisa.
The okay? Qisa itself, the cloak itself.
Yeah.
I've heard that materialistically speaking, that was the cloak that was given to Prophet Muhammad by Gabriel or something. Is it so? I mean, the very action itself seems to be very much spiritual rather than materialistic, Sheikh Karimi.
As I mentioned, there are, I mean, various versions of this event.
The story, that's right.
One of them is what you refer to. The other one is Qisa Khaybari,
uh-huh,
which means that it seems that it was maybe a gift or a piece of cloth coming from that region uh-huh, around the city
okay,
of Medina.
Okay.
Now, going to the question of hadith of Qisa. Now, the question yes, is that what about the hadith of
Qisa? Authenticity
of
hadith yeah, of Qisa, that's right.
If you want to go through this discussion based on Rijali discussion, Sheikh Abbas Qummi himself in Muntaha al-Amal, he says that many scholars like Sheikh Qulayni, Sheikh Atusi, Sheikh al-Mufid, Tabrisi, and Ibn Shahr Ashub, they have narrated this hadith of Qisa with different wordings. So Sheikh Abbas Qummi, he himself believes that this is an authentic narration. But many other scholars believe that this very hadith, as mentioned by Sheikh Abbas Qummi, is not mentioned in early books. It was mentioned by Al-Muntakhab by Turayhim, and later Awalim al-Ulum by Abdullah Bahrani and Isfahani.
Mm-hmm.
So if you are going to analyze this hadith in terms of Rijal, many scholars believe that it's not an authentic narration, but even having said that, it doesn't mean that we are not allowed to read that. No, for example, yes, Atul Makam Shirazi says that the content of this hadith is approved, it is confirmed by other narrations, and people can read this for the intention of Raja, hoping that they may receive the reward mentioned in this very hadith.
Mm-hmm.
There are many, and of course, the seerah, yes, the conduct of our scholars, great scholars of our time, it also shows that they really believed in this hadith, and they encouraged the believers to do that. So my point that the event is for sure, something certain.
Mm-hmm.
The hadith itself might be, challenged in terms of the rijal, in terms yes, of the narrators, but about the content, again, the content is well approved. And at least people can read it for the intention of Raja or hope.
That's all right. Also a nice distinguisher, we can say, between the previous ahadith which Prophet Muhammad told about the other members of his companions, for example, Salmanu minna Ahlul Bayt, okay? So, I mean, this Ahlul Bayt that Prophet Muhammad is referring to over here is very much different from Hadith al-Kasawa. Yeah. So, again, in order to show the people true way of the guidance after his demise, Prophet Muhammad on different occasions, based on different revelations, tried to make a context for the true guidance and the hidayah of the people. Thank you very much, Sheikh Karimi, for a nice elaboration regarding Hadith al-Kasa. Again, I want our dear listeners, in order to go and Google the paintings by Hassan Ruhul Amin with religious theme, also Hadith al-Kasa one is a beautiful painting by this man. Thank you very much, Sheikh Karimi. I really enjoyed talking to you, brother.
My pleasure.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs with me, Atta, the host of the program, and Sheikh Karimi. For more information, and also to download for free our other episodes, visit our website, iranradio.ir. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Inna fil jannati nahran min laban li Ali wa Hussein wa Hassan. Li Ali wa Hussein wa Hassan. إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن علي
This life as you know, you reap what you sow. And when you do good, Allah will protect you and stop you falling down. Allah, we surrender, cause He knows all, no compromise. Hears your laugh and feels your cry, He is there all the time. Make dua, praise Allah, our iman will grow. Inshallah, we will go far, there's a long way to go. We praise Allah, it's from the heart, love will keep us whole. And when you're feeling down, you know the way to go. Allah, yeah, Allah.
bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The plight of Palestinian inmates in Israeli prisons has become a defining human rights crisis, exposing what many advocacy groups and international observers describe as systematic crimes against detainees. Reports from UN agencies and Palestinian prisoner advocacy groups document a disturbing pattern of torture, sexual violence, starvation, medical neglect, and arbitrary detention without trial. With thousands imprisoned, including women and children, many held under administrative detention, the incarceration system has become an extension of broader policies of domination and dehumanization. I am Bahman Nouri, your host, and this spotlight seeks to see whether these practices constitute not isolated abuses, but a deliberate institutionalized machinery of oppression that violates international law and the most fundamental principles of human dignity. Let us begin with the report.
Since the outbreak of Israel's genocidal war on Gaza, Palestinian men and women held in Israeli military and prison facilities have faced systematic ill-treatment, including torture, sexual violence, and severe neglect. Many have died after being abducted and held under inhuman conditions. According to a 2024 report by the UN Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, many inmates from Gaza and the West Bank have been held arbitrarily, blindfolded, shackled, and often without being informed of the reasons for their detention or granted access to legal counsel. Also, testimonies from released prisoners describe repeated beatings, stress positions, electric shocks, the use of dogs during interrogations, and forced nudity or other forms of degrading treatment. Many detainees return to their families or to medical examiners with signs of severe beatings, starvation, and untreated medical conditions.
They use tear gas against us every week. It's difficult to describe the pain we suffered in the prison. The men were constantly being beaten.
We weren't allowed to sleep. They forced us to stay awake for 16 hours. The food is terrible. You need permission to go to the toilet. They forbid us from praying.
Local NGOs say nearly 100 Palestinians have died in Israeli prisons or detention centers since 2 years ago. The real number is believed to be far higher due to a lack of transparency, missing detainees, and Israeli regime's refusal to release full information. UN experts have repeatedly raised the alarm over arbitrary detentions and widespread mistreatment of prisoners. They have demanded Israel immediately end the systematic torture and abuse of Palestinian detainees to protect their rights to life and to allow independent oversight.
There continue to be the use of practices that clearly violate the prohibition on torture and other cruel, inhuman or degrading treatments, such as constant blindfolding, stress positions, handcuffing for extended periods of time, overcrowding, degrading conditions.
Israeli officials have denied access to independent monitors and have failed to comply with court orders demanding improved food, hygiene, and medical care inside detention facilities. Global human rights organizations warn without an independent international investigation and full detainee information, prisoners and their families will continue to be denied justice and more detainees will remain at risk.
Welcome back. Allow me to introduce my guests. Mohamed Al-Ghiq, political analyst, writer, and former Palestinian prisoner, joining us from Ramallah. And Leila Hatoum, editor-in-chief from MENA Uncensored, joining us from Beirut. Well, it is indeed a pleasure to have my guest with me. It is a very important topic, and I'm going to start. Let me see which one of my guests is available right now. Mohammed Ali is with me right now. Mohammed, I'm going to start the conversation with you. First, I want to talk about the legal and more specifically the international law perspective. These administrative detentions, how do they align with or contradict international legal standards?
Yeah, thank you for having me. First and foremost, Israel ignored the international community, ignored the international law. And by the way, it uses the administrative detention as a tool to torture the Palestinians, to prevent them from their life, to distract their daily life, their future, under the pretext of secret informations or files to prevent them from resistance, etc. I think the recent actions from the Israeli prison service and the Israeli army, the Israeli government, indicate the systematic, the organized policies against the Palestinians, the Palestinian prisoners, their life. The Palestinian prisoners, by the way, have been subjected to torture, isolation, medical negligence, all of these types of restrictions or collective punishment, as you like to name, all these policies, I think, Israel took it because took them because the absence of the accountability, the absence of the real will of the international community, the international law, and the silence of the Arab countries, the Muslim countries, that encouraged Israel to take bolder steps against the Palestinian prisoners by starving them, isolating them, right, torturing them. This is the point here, and with these conditions, I think Israel will take more steps against them.
Mohammed, now that they are, you're assuming that these are like contrary to the international law, what I want you to tell me, can these actions be also classified as war crimes or crimes against humanity?
This is an important question. Thank you for this question. We are here. Let's look at a bigger picture now. We saw the measures of ICJ and ICC against Netanyahu, Yoav Gallant, and some officials in Israel. But we didn't see any action from ICJ, at least, against the head of the Israeli prison service. She has to be held the accountability, the accountable here. And we didn't see any actions. That means the pressure from the U.S. on the ICJ and ICC, even the United Nations, is huge to prevent them from take any points or any steps against Israel. Now, with this situation, okay, Israel will go ahead against the Palestinians. By the way, they are preparing for execution bill against the Palestinian prisoners to achieve many goals here. And why they wanted that?
Right.
Because they paralyzed will of the international community.
Indeed, very insightful. Thank you so much, Mohammed. Well, gladly, Leila Hatoum is also with us right now. Leila is editor-in-chief of MENA Uncensored. Great to have you on this program. Leila, we're talking about the legal perspective on the issue of abuses that are happening and occurring and reoccurring in Israeli jails. Now that we can consider them, if we can consider them like crimes against humanity and war crimes, what will be the role of the International Criminal Court now?
Most definitely not only crimes against humanity, but war crimes as well. You have to understand, under international law, Israel is considered an occupation power. That's why the United Nations calls the West Bank the occupied Palestinian territories. In that sense, the occupation has duties and obligations. One of them is not to persecute or ethnically cleanse the land, or basically do arbitrary detention and torturing people. So at the end of the day, because of the state of war between the Palestinians and the Israeli occupation, because of the state of the occupation under international law, this is considered not only a crime against humanity, but also a war crime. Needless to say that every war crime is a crime against humanity in that sense, detaining people without basically arbitrary detention without any basically cause, at the same time torture, sexual assault, raping, among other things, electrocution, constant blindfolding, all of those constitute crimes. However, you have to bring them to the court of justice, be it the ICJ through countries, like basically South Africa did to the genocide that's happening in Gaza, or basically to the ICC against certain individuals to be able to prosecute the Israelis over that matter. Unfortunately, until today, we did not see neither the Palestinian Authority nor the states actually bringing these cases to the ICJ. They only brought the cases that were happening in Gaza, the constant genocide over there, to actually go after the Israeli occupation and its officers and its basically officials as well. So in the next phase, we need to see states and what you call larger entities, like Human Rights Watch, among others, moving such cases at the ICC level. So no matter what, we need to have cases to be able to prosecute the Israelis. However, I do understand that the ICC and the ICJ are paper tigers. They're toothless. They have no ability to implement their decisions. So in that sense, you have to have the victims or their families file individual lawsuits or class action lawsuits
right.
against Israeli officials who are directly tied to such crimes like Ben-Gvir, among others, in different countries across the world.
Right, Mohammed. Well, of course, you're a former prisoner. You've experienced and been through the Israeli prison life. I want you to tell me, to what extent do you believe policies like this administrative detention are rooted in security concerns rather than political directives?
Yes, as your guest, Laila, said, the international community, the international law, put Israel and encouraged Israel to go through these policies, like the administrative detention. Okay, when they arrested me, for example, they accused me with many charges, like military actions, etc. I refused these charges. They threatened me to go through the administrative detention or to admit these charges. I refused, and they changed me, and they turned me to administrative detention. I began my hunger strike against that. Why they use this policy, the administrative detention, to achieve many goals, to prevent the Palestinian resistance in the West Bank, and to vanish or to destroy the spiritual soul of the Palestinians, especially the prisoners inside jails, to intimidate the Palestinian people, the internal front, and to deter the leaders of the resistance in the West Bank, or influencers, writers, academic staffs, students, all these sectors, Israel considered them as a terrorism or as a threat against its existence. This is the policy of Israel against the Palestinians in the West Bank under many pretexts. Now they use the same policy against the Palestinians from Gaza, from West Bank, Jerusalem. Why? To achieve these goals, to deter the Palestinians. I think with the silence of the international community, Israel considers itself above the international law. And by the way, it took bolder steps against the Palestinians to torture them, to isolate them. By the way, we saw the two recent stories in one day, just in one day. The story of Tasnim and Hams from Gaza and her conditions reflect the situation inside
right.
Israel, the reality there. And the second story from Jenin. After they arrested two people there, they shoot them, they killed them. Why? This is the law of as jungle land. They use these policies against the Palestinians because the absence of the accountability.
Right. Leila, I wanted to talk to you about the effect of this aggressive and inhumane, one must say, prisoner policies in Israel and how it affects the broader Israeli-Palestine conflict?
Well, you have to understand that the Israelis are not there to actually create peace between them and the Palestinians or any of their neighbors. In that sense, they have to create an atmosphere of animosity around them. And how do they do that? By targeting every generation. It's really, it's very rare to find a single Palestinian, be it a child, a teenager, or a man, who hasn't served, even a woman, by the way, who haven't served some time in the Israeli concentration camps. These are not prisons. Again, this is an occupation, so these are concentration camps. Most of them have basically suffered under arbitrary detention and administrative detention, as we call it, which is detaining people without cause for lengthy periods of time. So at the end of the day, they are creating that atmosphere of animosity around them to create that friction and to tell the world, look at us. We are trying to find peace over here, but the people around us hate peace and they keep attacking us, so we have to eliminate them. The way that it reflects on the Palestinian society and the relations between the Israelis and the Palestinians, there will always be vendetta. I mean, if they haven't killed somebody from a Palestinian family, they have surely detained one and tortured one, and they have taken loved ones away from their families. In that sense, they will continue to disrupt the fabric within the Palestinian society, and they will continue to create that friction. And eventually, basically, we saw what happened. Tension in Gaza, tension in the West Bank. Today, they have basically cleaned the Palestinian refugee camps of nearly 56,000 Palestinians. They are not allowed to go back to their basically camps in the West Bank, right? And they have detained most of them, including one of the mayors from Tammuz. So when you look at the whole situation, the Israelis are looking to create that friction so they can use it as an excuse to continue to take further land and attack the Palestinians. The Palestinians will feel left out by the international community, as usual, and they will have to take matters into their own hands, and then they will be blamed for it, and they will be called terrorists. It will be always that broken record of the Israelis creating a problem, the Palestinians retaliating to it, then the Palestinians will be blamed for the fact that they are actually retaliating.
Right, Mohammed, if you remember a few weeks ago, when the video of the Israeli abuse in prison was leaked by a high-ranked military official of Israel, we were discussing this, and you said this is not just to inform others, this is to instill fears, and this is a propaganda step by the Israeli regime. It's well thought of. I want to talk about the Israeli domestic politics. How do you think they affect such prisoner policies?
I think Israel implements the carrot and stick policy against the Palestinians, and measures, and desperate times, desperate measures. They don't care about the humanity. They don't care about human laws or humanitarian coordination or something else, or even the humanitarian protocol. They violated the international law. They violated all the international laws, most notably the Fourth Geneva Convention of 1949. But I will be precise here. The Israeli government intensified these policies against the Palestinians to achieve the main goal for them, the nucleus goal, to expand it, its territories, and to put more pressure on the Palestinians, especially in the West Bank. When you see the daily life in the West Bank, you will be surprised. Checkpoints, military barriers, iron gates, demolishing homes, confiscating land, and they intensified the settlers' attacks against the Palestinian properties, main roads, water springs, pastoral areas, etc. Why Israel implemented these policies? To annex the West Bank, to cram people into the hard cities, and to deter the Palestinians, to prevent the resistance, and to send a message to the neighboring countries that Israel has a plan, and it coordinated its plan with Trump to go through the new Middle East project, to go through a greater Israel, at the expense of the Palestinians, at the expense of the neighboring countries, at the expense of the stability and prosperity in the region. This is the point for Israel, because of that they use these policies against prisoners, against people, against civilians in the West Bank and Gaza, even in Jerusalem.
Right, Leila, I want to not talk about the international reactions to these allegations. Ethically speaking, what is the responsibility of the global communities and also the NGOs, both in recording these abuses and responding to them?
It is complicit on this in this matter. Otherwise, the Israelis wouldn't have been flying above the radar and above international law. They have impunity because of this lack of action, the inaction of the international community. We have 192 member states of the United Nations and one entity, which is the occupation entity. And the 192, you only have about 191 who actually didn't take any action, and only one took an action. That's basically Iran. We have to be very, very clear about this. The only state that took action as a state is Iran. The rest of the states, they didn't do anything. Sending few packages of food over here and there, throwing some money to the on the problem, it doesn't change anything. Boycott should have been played on a wider scale. It didn't. And that's the least that they could have done. They kept the Israeli entity as a member, quasi-member of the United Nations. The United Nations didn't kick them out or suspend them. And that's very interesting to see. And then you have the big five countries protecting the Israeli entity. So at the end of the day, I'm looking at complicity, hypocrisy, and the will not to do any action. This is by will. This is actually something that they chose to do.
Regarding this willingness, Mohammed, I want to see, what do you think about the Israeli response to all the UN resolutions, some international calls that exist in order to end these alleged abuses of the Palestinian detainees? What does it say about Israel's willingness to engage with global accountability mechanisms?
Unfortunately, let me clarify something for you. The recent decision from the Security Council about Gaza vanished all the resolutions, all the decisions to give the Palestinians their rights. And by the way, the recent decision gave Israel more self-confidence, gave Israel more a huge permission to go through the annexation plan, to go through its policies against the Palestinians. And when we are talking about the international community, the complicity, the silence of the Arab regimes, we are talking about the massacres of Israel and bolder steps on the ground. What is the point of United Nations Charter if it doesn't stop the starvation, the genocide, the ethnic cleansing in the West Bank, the organized policies against the Palestinian prisoners, at least to give the Palestinians their right? We heard many stories from the Israeli jails, not to mention CDT Man, rape crimes, or etc. Something about the Palestinian prisoners. We are talking about the reality now. Israel wanted to change the reality in the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, Jerusalem, and the neighboring countries to implement its plan. And we have to see the actions from the international community. Now, we have nothing. All these efforts will be in vain because there is no accountability now. Let me tell you about the prisoners. We didn't hear or we didn't see any statement from the international community of the Red Cross about the Palestinian prisoners and the subjugation and the policies against them. But we are hearing many statements. We are seeing many stances from the international community, from the international institutions about the Israeli prisoners, and they asked, they demanded to bring them back home. But about the Palestinian prisoners, nothing. This is the double standards policy.
Right. It was a pleasure to have you both on this show. Thank you so much, Mohammed Al-Ghig, political analyst, writer, and former Palestinian prisoner joining us from Ramallah, and also Leila Hatoum, editor-in-chief of MENA Uncensored, joining us from Beirut. So this was another Spotlight. Thank you so much for staying with us.
Welcome back, dear listeners, and thank you for staying with us. Iran Radio presents some interesting facts about the Holy Quran. The word Bismillah appears 114 times in the Quran. It occurs twice in chapter An-Naml, whereas chapter Tawbah is the only surah which does not begin with Bismillah. Quran believes in life after death, and the Quran teaches us that besides having a body, a human being also has a spirit, a soul. And when a person dies, the physical body vanishes, while the soul remains. We are here, and we continue our broadcast from Iran Radio with these incredible programs. Our next program is News, keeping you in the know with all the latest updates. Then we have A to Z of Life. Next up, we will dive into a collection of our finest radio productions. Following that, Islamic Laws clarifies faith for everyday life. Hujjatul Islam, Sheikh Javed Akbari, hosts Islamic Laws, discussing Islamic jurisprudential rule.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
UNICEF warns thousands of children still suffer from acute malnutrition in Gaza, and over 9,000 cases were reported in October alone. Hamas categorically slams Israel's escalating raids and abduction of Palestinians across the occupied West Bank as a war crime and state-sponsored terrorism. And Venezuela condemns Donald Trump's announcement about closure of its airspace as a colonialist threat against the country's sovereignty and a violation of international law. Hello everyone, thank you for joining us here on World News. Our top story: Israeli forces continue to violate the ceasefire with Hamas in the Gaza Strip, killing more civilians across the war-torn territory. In one of the latest violations, they killed two children in the southern city of Khan Yunis. Now, according to Palestinian officials, they were 8 and 11-year-old brothers from the Bani Sohaila neighborhood. And the overall death toll from regime's genocide now stands at over 70,100. And our Gaza correspondent, Moti Abu Musabe, joined us earlier with more